insisting for months that he would stay, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez is going. Gonzalez, the nation's first Hispanic Attorney General, made it official in a brief statement at the Justice Department this morning.
I often remind our fellow citizens that we live in the greatest country in the world, and that I have lived the American dream. Even my worst days as Attorney General have been better than my father's best days.
Well, there were a lot of bad days for Alberto Gonzalez. His resignation ends a wrenching standoff with congressional critics who question his honesty and confidence at the helm of the Justice Department. Evan Perez covers the Justice Department for The Wall Street Journal. Evan, Gonzalez spoke for less than 2 minutes today. He didn't answer questions that were shouted at him by reporters as he left the podium. But what are you hearing? Why is he leaving?
Essentially, he looked at the at what was coming up once the Congress came back, and he saw what was heading his way, which was an even more intense grilling regarding important things like the terror surveillance program that what the administration calls the terror surveillance program, which, as you know, has become a really big controversy and has grown as months have gone on. And he knew that Congress had some very big questions to ask about his role in some key parts of that.
Questions about warrantless wiretapping and the like.
Correct.
Well, President Bush also spoke this morning. He said Alberto Gonzalez did an outstanding job. And, in fact, you know, gave him credit for a lot of post-9/11 legislation, including the Patriot Act, for instance. He gave Alberto Gonzalez credit for a lot of things that his opponents are blaming him for. Remind us, tick off the criticisms of Alberto Gonzalez.
And that's exactly what the problem is for him, is that these are the things that the president most likes about him, and these are the things that people, civil libertarians, people who are very wary of the growth of what the government's power has been since 9/11, are also, you know, kind of blame him for. And essentially, you know, he's seen as the person who helped write some of the most stringent laws about what the government can do to listen to for as far as surveillance, and can listen, you know, for looking for enemies of the country.
We mentioned warrantless wiretapping, which Gonzalez pushed for as Attorney General, but earlier as White House counsel, some say he pushed for it at the hospital bedside of then Attorney General John Ashcroft, signed off on the controversial terror memo that called the Geneva Convention quaint, sought to limit the legal rights of detainees at Guantanamo Bay. But, you know, his defenders, of course, say that he was being pummeled for actions that weren't extraordinary at all. What is the sense that's forming today of Alberto Gonzalez?
Well, the sense of the Justice Department is that it's kind of one of relief, actually. You know, they've been sort of pummeled in the last few months, and essentially, you know, I think the Justice Department was, I mean, the morale was way down. There's a number of top vacancies that are still not filled, and essentially every time the Attorney General tried to go to Capitol Hill to talk about anything important, you know, he had to raise his right hand. He joked about that the other day, and you know, it's not a joke, actually.
Yeah,
because it's true, and so there is a sense of relief. I mean, a lot of his aides had tears in their eyes this morning as he spoke, because I think he's a very likable guy, and I think people will miss him. But I think they knew that it was time.
Well, we hear that taking his place initially might be Solicitor General Paul Clement. He'll be acting as Attorney General. But what about a long-term replacement? Just briefly.
Clement could possibly be a longer-term replacement. I mean, he's well-liked by Republicans and Democrats. Michael Chertoff has been named today as
Homeland Security Director.
Homeland Security, right, correct. He could have a tough time because of immigration issues. There's other names like Larry Thompson, who's a former Deputy Attorney General, who's a General Counsel at PepsiCo, and obviously he's making a lot of money right now. I doubt anybody would, in their right mind, give up their a job like that to go back to being to do this job.
Yeah, well, again, we shall see. And it suddenly, as we always say, August is said to be a slow news month. It never is.
That's right.
Evan Perez covers the Justice Department for the Wall Street Journal. Evan, thanks.
Pleasure.
Alberto Gonzalez, of course, also questioned about his role in the firing of federal prosecutors. We're going to hear from one of those prosecutors in a few moments. But we turn first to two law professors with very differing views of Bush administration policies and Alberto Gonzalez. Jonathan Turley is professor of law at George Washington University. Welcome, as always, Jonathan.
Thank you, Robin.
And Doug Kimek is professor of law at Pepperdine University. He advised Presidents Reagan and George Bush on constitutional law matters while at the Justice Department from 1985 to 1989. And Douglas, we welcome you back as well.
Robin, good to be with you.
And Douglas, I want to get your reaction first to the announcement today.
Well, I think the Attorney General had come in for some particularly harsh criticism, as often is the case in Washington. Some of it was deserved. Much of it was undeserved. I think the Attorney General stayed in office largely to preserve the prerogatives of the office of the presidency in a very important time, especially with regard to issues of national security. I also think there were some management difficulties in the Department of Justice, some of which the Attorney General admitted in terms of the dismissals of the U.S. attorneys, which I thought was not well handled and indeed was the heart and the beginning of his undoing.
Well, let's go to your other thought, that he was in the office to preserve the prerogatives of the president. His many critics, including Republicans, Arlen Specter, for instance, said the Justice Department was close to dysfunctional, said that Alberto Gonzalez served the president too much, that he was once the president's lawyer and forgot that as Attorney General, he was the lawyer for all Americans.
Well, I think that was only true in part. I think with respect to the basic principles at stake, whether or not the president has the ability to appoint and supervise and therefore dismiss those who are not serving him in the manner in which he thinks best, that's a principle that needs to be defended. The Attorney General defended it well. With respect to the issue of the terrorist surveillance program, there's no question but that that has been a vital aspect of our defense since 9/11. The Attorney General laid out a very expansive defense of that program as well as he could in light of its classified nature. And I think by virtue of those two things, he did a good service for the country. The problem is that with respect to some of those principles, their utilization was mistaken. The dismissals of the U.S. attorneys was never fully justified, never explained as to why that was delegated in the manner it was delegated inside the department. And that was at the beginning, as I say, of the Attorney General's undoing.
Now, Jonathan Turley, do you think Alberto Gonzalez did Americans a service?
No, I don't. I think that history will be very harsh when looking back at Gonzalez. You know, this is a sad moment, but it's truly a moment of his own making. You know, I honestly believe that years from now, it may occur to Gonzalez to look back and think whether he would have served the president better, and certainly the country better, and most certainly himself better, if he had exercised more independent judgment. That, you know, he was known throughout his career, back in Texas, all the way through his career as Attorney General, as being something of an enabler for George Bush. You know, when people wanted to engage in practices defined as torture under national law, Gonzalez was there with pen in hand, ready to sign the memo.
Well, let's just broad brush. Give us an example. We're reminded today of when Alberto Gonzalez served in Texas. He advised then-Governor George Bush that the Vienna Conventions, for instance, didn't pertain to Texas. Remind us of that case.
Well, it's not just that case, but that he, from that very moment, he was telling Bush what he wanted to hear, that his power was unchecked, that he'd had few limitations. One of the things he was criticized for is that in his briefings on capital punishment cases, Gonzalez would reduce them dramatically, leaving out critical facts like sleeping lawyers, and these are death cases. And he was heavily criticized that he had just turned this process into the appearance of process, but that he had removed all the substance. And that ultimately became the signature of his time as both White House counsel and Attorney General. That, you know, when the president wanted to declare citizens enemy combatants and strip them of constitutional rights, Gonzalez was there to say you could do it.
Doug Kimek, the case that Jonathan and I were referring to is the one in which I'm sure you're well aware there was a death row inmate, a Mexican, in Texas. And by Vienna Convention law, Mexico should have been notified that one of their citizens was to be put to death. And Alberto Gonzalez overruled that. Do you think he played fast with international law? Is that a charge that can be made against him?
Well, Robin, it's a good question. I think ultimately he was vindicated because, as Jonathan knows, in the last term of the Supreme Court, in the case called Sanchez-Yamez, the Supreme Court of the United States said that the International Court of Justice had misconstrued the terms of the Vienna Convention in terms of the extent of the U.S.'s obligation to engage in that notification. And in any event, that the convention said the Supreme Court of the United States could not overturn the rules of procedure of the Texas Criminal Court of Appeals. So in many ways, the Attorney General's judgment on that question was vindicated. On the larger point, there's no question but that the Attorney General had a very difficult role to play. He had to simultaneously be candid and objective with the president, telling the president where the limits of his authority were, and at the same time to be very well informed about the importance of exercising and defending the president's powers at a moment in time when the United States was facing an enemy that it had not faced before. And I think while there were some missteps made, most of the direction that he took, especially in the area of the war on terror, is entirely defensible.
Well, how much was Alberto Gonzalez, do you think, driving Bush administration policy when it came to detainees, when it came to the view of the Geneva Convention and torture, when it came to wiretapping? How much was he driving it or just acquiescing?
Well, I don't think he was acquiescing. The one thing that I know for a certainty with regard to Alberto Gonzalez is that he is a careful listener and that he is quite good at discerning where there is substantial legal argument and where there is not. On the issue of torture in particular, of course, that was largely guided by the Department of Justice before Alberto Gonzalez took office. I think the legitimate criticism there is that he could have raised in comments to the effect that the DOJ memo had been written far more broadly than it needed to be written at the time, and he did not. On the other hand, with regard to the terrorist surveillance program, it seems to me that in that particular instance, again, the Attorney General has been largely vindicated because the nature of the program that he authorized, that he advocated, has now been approved by the Congress of the United States by the most recent amendments. So I think these are things that we can't overlook when we examine the record of the Attorney General. It's mixed, but in some important ways, it's also successful.
That's law professor Douglas Kamek from Pepperdine University. We've also been speaking with Jonathan Turley from George Washington University about the resignation of Alberto Gonzalez. Here are some of President Bush's thoughts earlier today.
It's sad that we live in a time when a talented and honorable person like Alberto Gonzalez is impeding from doing important work because his good name was dragged through the mud for political reasons.
Well, when we come back, we'll get a very different view from a fired U.S. attorney. That's after a break. But later in the show, you thought you were having a hard time selling your home. Home Depot just had to drop the price of one of its divisions by almost $2 billion. Back after a break here and now. Professors Jonathan Turley and Douglas Kamek, their opinion on today's resignation of Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. Jonathan, some say a turning point for Alberto Gonzalez came when former Deputy Attorney General James Comey told Congress about a bedside meeting that Gonzalez, then White House counsel, had with then Attorney General John Ashcroft to push Ashcroft to approve part of the warrantless wiretapping program. We asked Doug this. Now your turn. How do you think history is going to see Gonzalez as someone who enabled or pushed Bush policy?
Well, my friend Doug talks about, you know, sometimes explaining the limits to the president. We've yet to find that instance where actually Gonzalez held up any program significantly and said this exceeds authority. And that's why he's viewed as something of an empty suit. In fact, his defense on the torture memo and his confirmation would have been embarrassing to most adults. He basically said, I didn't read the memo that closely. And in the U.S. attorney's scandal, he said, I take responsibility, but really I was just doing what my aides told me to do. And so he often goes back to the chief criticism and embraces it as a defense. But his legacy is going to be much more troubling than just that. You know, he's been criticized for politicalization of the Justice Department, of putting people in who had very few credentials to put forward, except a sort of Baathist party-like loyalty.
Well, Doug Kamek has said he disagrees. Doug, I'm wondering, there are reports today that Gonzalez resigned because Congress is gearing up for an investigation into the warrantless wiretapping program. Do you think he could have held up to those questions? He's done so poorly in his testimony so far.
You know, I do think the Attorney General could have withstood more hearings and could have given his answers yet again. But I also think the Attorney General understands that he has an obligation to larger institutions and that his primary interest was the larger institution of the Office of the Presidency. I think in light of this moment in time, Robin, and this moment in time is where Congress of the United States has approved amendments to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that largely coincide with the direction that the Attorney General gave the President of the United States. That was a major piece of his executive administration of the law, and having accomplished that, I think it was an apt time to say the costs of explaining yet again the relationship between the White House and the Department of Justice on the dismissal of U.S. attorneys is not worth it. And I give him credit for that, because that here's where Jonathan and I do entirely agree, and that is the handling of that U.S. attorney matter was extraordinarily poor. It was a delegation of responsibility to young people, political people in the Department of Justice that should not have occurred. To politicize their office is a very serious error.
Well, what happens now, though, Jonathan Turley? First of all, to questions that still remain about Alberto Gonzalez's role, what do those questions just go unanswered?
Well, in Washington, there has been a tendency to accept resignations as pretty much bringing to a close investigations. That may not be the case entirely with Gonzalez. He waited too long. The Justice Department has been frozen in amber in all of these controversies, and Gonzalez kept on telling his people, I'm basically going to stand up to my critics, I'm going to finish my term. Well, now these investigations are out there. There's been a lot of fixed assets put in place to complete them. But more importantly, the Congress is finding some disturbing things about Karl Rove's use of the Justice Department and how much the political people at the White House dictated things to the professional staff of the Justice Department itself.
Well, Doug Kamek, what about the position that he's leaving? The thinking on the part of many analysts prior to this announcement was that he would never leave because the White House would not want to undergo confirmation hearings for his successor. Is the last Attorney General and the White House going to be on, you know, on trial as well as the new nominee when the confirmation hearings start?
My answer, Robin, is that if the president selects wisely, the answer will be no, because if you select someone of great integrity, great competence, management ability, who's beyond reproach, then yes, there will be questions about how someone would have handled something. But I think the nominee and the interests of the legislature will largely be better served by being prospective.
Douglas Kamek is professor of law at Pepperdine University. He served in the Justice Department under Presidents Reagan and George Bush the Senior. Jonathan Turley, professor of law at George Washington University, both commenting on the announced resignation today of Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. Gentlemen, thank you both.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, joining us on the line now, one of the nine federal prosecutors who was fired, Bud Cummins, served as U.S. attorney in Little Rock, Arkansas, before being fired last year to create a position for a former top aide to then-White House advisor Karl Rove. Bud Cummins, your reaction to the resignation of Alberto Gonzalez?
Well, I think it was necessary for the leadership in the Department of Justice. This attorney general had lost his credibility through his own actions and statements and also through the politics involved, but the bottom line is he was not able to continue to lead the department. And, you know, on a personal level, I'm relieved to see him out from under this pressure. He's a man with a wife and kids, and I'm sure it's been the worst 6 months of his life.
Well, so. but you know, has it been deserved? I mean, you know, first of all, to your comments that it's good that he went, is that just because he fired you?
No, it doesn't have anything to do with him firing me. The reason he deserved to lose his credibility has more to do with what they did to explain the firings, and more particularly the firings of the other seven that were fired in December.
By saying it was performance related.
Right. That they really just deliberately chose to slander their professional reputations to avoid telling the truth about the political nature behind the decisions.
Because
that's really unforgivable.
You've said that, in fact, you've served at the pleasure of the president. They had any right to fire you, but to give the wrong reason was what rubbed you the wrong way.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they could fire us at any time, and they did, and that we were all going quietly, but they didn't have the right to try and claim that some people had performance problems when they didn't, and they clearly didn't.
Well, you testified in Congress about a phone call you received that you found, you said you found menacing. It was from Michael Elston, a top justice official. You said that Elston expressed concern that you and the other dismissed prosecutors were talking to reporters, and that Elston suggested justice officials might feel compelled to somehow pull their gloves off. What did that say to you about the Justice Department?
It said that they had allowed a bunch of political operatives to have jobs of importance and responsibility at the Department of Justice that they weren't mature enough or experienced enough to handle.
Bud Cummins, former U.S. attorney in Little Rock, Arkansas, one of nine federal prosecutors fired last year, at the heart of questions about Alberto Gonzalez's reign as head of the Justice Department. Bud Cummins, thank you.
Thank you.
And just think, it's only Monday. We'll continue to follow the story. After a break, Bud Collins on the U.S. Open, Here and Now. Support for Here and Now. Existing home sales are down for the fifth month in a row, down 0.1% in July, according to the National Association of Realtors report, which is out today. What we just heard on Friday from the Commerce Department, which says new home sales rose 2.8% last month after dropping 4% in June. And both of these reports come amid a credit crunch in the housing market that's rippling throughout the industry. Home Depot just agreed to lower the sale price of its wholesale supply unit by almost $2 billion. We're going to have more on that. But first, what's up with home sales? Henny Sender is senior special writer for The Wall Street Journal. Henny, existing home sales, as I just said, down. They're about 85% of the market. But new home sales numbers are up. So what do you think tea leaf readers are going to take from this?
The thing that the markets are really hoping for is a Federal Reserve rate cut. And the fact that the new home sales are positive will kind of maybe throw off that optimistic certainty that the Fed would save Wall Street by cutting rates.
Because the thought is that if the home sales continue to plummet, maybe the Feds would cut the rate so that there's more money to go around and people
exactly.
can afford
so
mortgages.
In a perverse way, you know, bad news would sort of put more pressure on the Fed to cut rates. At this point, everyone is looking at every single economic data point for clues about how well the economy is doing. And at the moment, what people would like to see is reasons from the data that would give the Fed an excuse to cut. The fact that new home sales are up might give the Fed pause.
Well, and it also dovetails into the Home Depot story. Let's talk about the Home Depot deal. Just 2 months ago, the Home Depot board agreed to sell its commercial supply business for about $10.5 billion. That deal, we understand, through intense negotiations and quick and hurried and late-night phone calls, dropped to almost $8.5 billion, an 18% drop from the original price. So first of all, explain to us what happened there.
Well, it was interesting. The private equity buyers have so much leverage in this deal. Home Depot is in a very troubled sector of the economy. So the private equity sponsors go to Home Depot and say, you know this price we agreed? Your outlook has deteriorated so much since then. And we think you ought to give us a better price.
And let's remind ourselves, we were just talking about home sales. Were they going to Home Depot, keeping in mind the fact that Home Depot, of course, supplies people who build homes with lumber and nails and all of that stuff? So if new home sales were down, which they were, that made Home Depot less valuable.
Absolutely. Home Depot less value and its subsidiary less valuable. So Home Depot says to its shareholders, please love us. We are going to buy back shares to support our share price, even though the outlook on a macro level isn't terrific. And how are they going to pay for the shares they were going to buy back in the market? They were going to use the cash from the sale of Home Depot supply to the private equity firms. They really counted on that cash. If the deal had not gone through, they wouldn't have had the money to fund their share buyback, and their own share price would have fallen. So the private equity firms astutely took advantage of this situation.
Well, and also, in addition to Home Depot being so involved in the home industry as it is, this is part of the story you've been hearing about for a couple of weeks now, that there just isn't a lot of money around, that there just isn't a lot of liquidity is the word that's being used. How much did that have to do with the reorganization of this deal?
Well, of course, there are many parts to this deal. We've talked about the relations between the seller and the buyer and how the buyer, you know, cudgeled the seller to get a better price. Then you have the negotiations between the buyers and the banks who are giving them the finance. And the banks are saying to the buyers, wait a minute, you said things are so terrible and the sellers have just given you a better deal. We're saying things are so terrible, give us, who are arranging the financing, a better deal. And that was actually what the last minute brinkmanship was all about.
So the bankers who are giving money to companies like Bain Capital, investment bankers who are buying out the subsidiary of Home Depot, they said to the buyers, we're not going to give you as much money. So there seems to be this, you know, huge ripple effect from what we're hearing is the failure of thousands, millions of mortgages. How else might we see this impact the economy? Or is Home Depot different because it's so involved with housing?
You know, if you look at the firms that the private equity firms have been buying, you know, Home Depot is at the heart of the troubled sectors. So it's no accident that we see this one as the first to be renegotiated, both between buyer and seller and between the buyer and the banks who are arranging the financing for them. But the fact is, you know, the mortgage problems will have ripple effects. You know, will car sales drop because consumers are nervous about the value of their homes? The mortgage market could still tip this country into a recession, regardless of these deals between the banks and the buyers.
Well, we've been reporting as well that Americans have been using their homes as, you know, what someone called piggy banks, you know, taking out further loans on their home equity lines and buying things like cars or paying for college education. And it sounds like that money's drying up.
Absolutely. I mean, so much economic growth in the past few years has been financed because everyone here has been borrowing. Companies have been borrowing, private equity firms have been borrowing, households have been borrowing. And now it's not just the value of their homes that are leaving people nervous. It's the willingness of the banks to lend money to everyone to keep buying and keeping the economy going. So to the extent that there is less borrowing, there will be slower growth.
Well, and you said that there's sighs of relief that the Home Depot deal even went through, even though it was, you know, 18% less than originally hoped for. But the New York Times quotes someone involved in that deal as saying, study what happened here. You'll see this movie again. Do you think that there's been a sigh of relief, or do you think we're going to see this happening again?
Well, from my point of view, this happening is a good thing compared to some of the alternatives. If the banks had not reached an agreement with the buyers and there was litigation and everyone was suing everybody else for walking away, there would have been more uncertainty for the debt market, and I think that outcome would have been even less favorable for all concerned.
You know, Henry, why should someone care if they're not buying or selling a house, if they don't own stock in Home Depot? Why should the average person care about this?
Because their neighbor surely will have borrowed money. And if economic growth slows, that hurts everybody. That means no matter how prudent you were, the company that you work for might not be as profitable tomorrow as it was yesterday, and that wage increase that you were hoping for may not materialize. So, I mean, we really can't isolate ourselves when we think about these things.
Henny Sender, senior special writer for The Wall Street Journal, speaking to us from New York. Henny, thanks.
My pleasure. Thank you.
When you put it that way. Okay, quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, a new documentary takes us to Libby, Montana, where hundreds of residents died from and are still dying from exposure to asbestos. It was in the town mine. Before they knew it was asbestos, they used it to mulch their gardens, to build a high school track and skating rink. Are they going to get justice in court? That's tomorrow. And before we go today, a look at the growing genre of urban lit. You're listening to Here and Now. A quick note, don't call me for the next 2 weeks because the U.S. Open begins today in Flushing Meadow, New York. We're not giving any scores. It's already underway, but we'll give a little preview with Boston Globe sports columnist Bud Collins. Bud, nice as always to speak with you.
Well, it's nice to speak to you, Robin, and it's going to be a wonderful Open. I believe the weather is supposed to be just about like today. It's about 80, and it's supposed to stay that way, and blue skies.
Excellent. One of the first matches is number one Roger Federer versus Scovel Jenkins. As we said, no scores. We're not going to tell people who want to catch the highlights tonight. But I'm interested in, I guess they call him Sco Jenkins. He had to qualify
he
for one of the...
He did have to qualify. Yeah. He's 21, and he's had his ups and downs. He played here a year ago. He got a wild card. He's a big kid, and I have hopes for him.
He was the first African-American to win the U.S. Junior Championship in 2004. Played Rafael Nadal in the second round of the U.S. Open in 2005. So there's talk about him. There's buzz around him.
Yeah, and it's a great opportunity to get out there on the stadium and play against the best guy in the game.
Well, we mentioned Rafael Nadal, Roger Federer's longtime rival, still looking for his first U.S. Open victory. Do you think he has a chance? I mean, he's the clay court specialist. He's won three French Opens.
He has beaten Federer on a hard court. And I thought he'd do better here. He hasn't done very well. He lost to Misha Yuzhny last year. I think, though, that he'll catch on to it, but I don't think he's going to win this year. I have the feeling about him that he might just lose in the semifinals to this hot young Serbian, Novak Djokovic.
Well, let's look at the women's side of today's U.S. Open. Last year's champion, Maria Sharapova, seeded second this year, but all analysts are saying she's going to have potentially an easier path to the finals than other top-rated players. Why is that?
Oh, you're right, Robin. Her half of the draw is the less adventurous. Everybody seems to be concentrated in the top with Justine Henin, the number one player. You've got both Williams sisters up there. You've got Yankovic, and it seems to be overcrowded with good players in the top. So if Maria can just keep going smoothly, she ought to get to the final.
So you're saying she's playing a different crop of players. So we might see some of the best players. You mentioned Henin and the Williams sisters. They might be playing each other.
Yeah, there'll be some bloodshed there because the sisters, unfortunately, will have to get past one another, one or the other,
right,
and if they get that far.
Well, what do you think of the Williams sisters? Serena still battling the thumb injury. She sprained her left thumb. Venus, of course, won Wimbledon. And in the Open, Serena seeded 8th, Venus 12th. So what do you think?
I think is a wrong seed. To my mind, Venus, the Wimbledon champion, ought to be seeded number 3, and Serena right after her.
You know, it's funny, that Venus was seeded 23 at Wimbledon. Remember, she was so low there.
And ranking even lower. Venus is my pick to win the tournament, but I think she'll probably have to beat her sister to do it. And Serena looks in shape for a change. We always sort of make a little bit of fun of her that there's more of her than there should be. But she came into Australia overweight, and she didn't let it bother her. She won the title dramatically, splendidly.
Right.
And if she hadn't fallen on her thumb at Wimbledon, she might have won that too.
Well, one last question. Also tonight, the U.S. Tennis Association is going to be honoring Althea Gibson, the first African-American to win the U.S. National Championship, which became the U.S. Open. She did that 50 years ago. Your thoughts about her legacy to the game?
I have three little words. It's about time. I wish they had honored her when she was alive so that she could have enjoyed it. She's almost been forgotten, Robin, which I think is terrible, because what she did, scaling the color bar at a time when tennis was largely a country club game run by starchy folks. She had a lot of indignities heaped on her in 1950 when she finally broke the color line, and I just don't think she's gotten enough credit. 10 years ago, when Arthur Ashe Stadium was dedicated, that was her 70th birthday. It was never mentioned, and they should have not only mentioned that it was her birthday, but reiterated what she had done for the game. And this is a wonderful celebration tonight, but to my mind, it should have happened a long time ago.
Boston Globe sports columnist Bud Collins also covers tennis for ESPN, giving us his thoughts on the U.S. Open, which starts today. Bud, any wardrobe plans that we should be in on?
Well, I've got some pretty unusual trousers with chili peppers on them, but it's the players we're more interested in here.
Bud, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
After the break, urban lit novelist Jeff Rivera, here and now. Jeffrey Rivera was working at a Kmart when a coworker told him a true story about the time he served in juvenile boot camp and the almost obsessive love he had for the woman he left behind. Well, Jeff decided to fictionalize his friend's story. Here, the central character, Dio, is about to enter the church where that woman he obsessed about is about to be married to another man. His friend Spooky begs him not to go inside.
Don't be stupid, fool. Don't be a bendejo. Dio looked at his homie Spooky's grip on his jacket. Most of his boys called Dio Playboy because all the ladies loved him. But those that had known him since he was a kid called him his real name Dio. He took another hit off his joint. He gave up smoking over a year ago, had to. But on this day, he was more nervous than he'd ever been in his entire life. Thunder rumbled and rain poured, making it impossible to see. Thunder scared Dio. Always had. Dio fought to keep from shaking. He couldn't breathe. Couldn't swallow. He tried to hide its fear. His mind was set. He had to do it. Dio yanked his arm away from Spooky and pushed the door open. Just keep the car running, I'd say.
With $200, Jeff Rivera published that story online, selling 3,000 copies. Eventually, the work was picked up by Warner Books, and now Forever My Lady has entered the new literary canon known as Urban Lit. No, it's not the polished product of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, but it is the truth, the violence, the strong language, and tough characters of inner-city street life. And in this case, it's also ultimately the softening of Dio, the fictional gangbanger sent to prison boot camp. And Jeff Rivera joins us from WLRN in Miami with more. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
You know, I found it interesting. Your character, Dio, who we left there, you know, walking into the church, when he's in boot camp, he's obsessive about writing letters to his girlfriend. And in my reading about you, you seem to be possessed to write as well. Can you explain the role that writing has played in your life?
Well, absolutely. For me, it's been a way of sort of therapy from the time I was little to explore my feelings and to get my feelings out on paper. There was a time when I really didn't have anyone other than my family as a friend, so a pen and pad became sort of my best friend.
Yeah, were you homeless at times?
Yeah, we were homeless at one time, and we lived in our car, and it was the most horrific time of my life, really. It was a time when we had nothing but each other. Yeah. We had 4 bedrooms worth of stuff in the back seat of the car. We had to wash our socks in the drainage of a gutter of the water. And we used to go up early in the morning and go to the grocery store and pray that they had something to eat, some samples, something. We had our pet turtle, our pet cockatiel, our goldfish in a cup, all in the car with us. But
how did that happen?
Basically, there was a situation happening in the home which made it uncomfortable for my mother to live there. And she decided that she needed to get out of that situation. And that ended up, you know, meaning that we're going to be living in her car for a while.
Mm. Well, getting out of a situation, I mean, that's at the bottom of the story that you write in your book. Dio, as we said, a lot of violence. He's locked up in a juvenile boot camp. And I'm thinking of various scenes that you have. You have a lot of his internal life, a lot of what he's thinking. He had been locked in a toy box by his alcoholic mom when he was a kid. The white supremacist kids in the boot camp gang up on other kids. But, you know, I think, are you setting up these characters for us just to feel sorry and understand that there's explanations for their violence? But no. You have his drill sergeant say to him, "Get over it. Get over it." What are you, Jeff, working through with that, you know, by setting that up that way?
Well, one of the reasons why I had that is that's a deliberate message to the readers that it doesn't matter. Everyone has a story that they've been through. Somebody who's gone through something worse than me. But to not use it as an excuse to not succeed, to not use it as an excuse to not be happy. So when Dio goes through what he's going through, Jackson tells him, look, so what? Boo-hoo. Boo-hoo. You know, everyone has a problem. You know, don't use it as an excuse to not move on with your life.
You know, we mentioned that he was obsessed with writing to this woman that he leaves behind when he goes into this boot camp. And at first you think, that's so sweet, you know. And then it starts to get, obsessive-compulsive and it starts to feel dangerous. I'm not going to tell what happens when he crosses that threshold and goes into the church where she, in fact, is marrying someone else. He could have become violent. You sent him in another direction. What are you saying to men through this character?
I'm saying it's very difficult for men to express himself, you know, emotionally. So Dio learns to do that through his letters. He learns to express himself all that he feels instead of keeping it inside. In the United States and really the world, we have a very interesting perspective on what is masculine and what, you know, what is feminine and what is appropriate. And Dio learns a little bit about that. And I think it's important, an important message for men, you know, all over the world to know that it's okay to express yourself.
That's how it feels at first, but then it starts to tip over into this possessiveness and ownership of her and threatening almost in the letters. And just because he was expressing himself so beautifully, it doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to get the result he wants.
Exactly. Jennifer really represents to him the answer to all of his happiness. That's why he becomes so desperate. And so when she doesn't respond the way he wants to respond, he becomes desperate and says hateful and mean things. I think that's believable. It's not acceptable. It's not appropriate, but it's believable. Mm-hmm. But he learns to rectify that. He learns to, you know, respond differently.
Well, let's talk about this genre that you are now a part of, this urban lit, because much of what you, by all rights, own, I mean, this is a life that you know about from, you know, from the street up in many ways. It's been co-opted, some would say, by television, by movies. I mean, we've heard and seen a lot of this by videos, certainly by rap. How do you keep it from either being cliched or feeling, you know, the competition from other writers in Urban Lit online and elsewhere to, you know, gee, I got to ratchet this up. Gee, but even maybe if it's not realistic. Sometimes I think rappers, when they're doing the rapping competitions, sort of they just keep upping the ante, but I don't think it doesn't feel as real.
Well, I think what makes Forever My Lady different than any other Urban Lit is that it is a story, a human story, that happens to be wrapped around the shroud, I guess you could say, of urban setting. So someone who lives in Iowa or lives in Nebraska can relate to it as well as somebody who lives in South Central, you know, or some other place. I think that's what makes it different. At the heart, everyone knows what it's like to want someone or to want something more than anything, and that person doesn't love you back, doesn't want you back. I think that's a human story. I think that's what makes it a little bit different. Yeah.
When are you going to write your story, you know, in the car with the goldfish in the bowl?
To me, my story is not that interesting, so I sort
really? Of... Really? Up from homelessness to a published book, so, you know, no?
Well, I mean, that's one thing that I do. When I go around the country and I talk to people, you know, I speak to people about my experiences and how they can turn it around and how I did that. That's sort of my way of telling my story. But as far as a book, I think there's so many other stories I want to tell.
And do I understand now that you're a concierge at the Ritz-Carlton? Did I read that?
That's correct. I do work at the Ritz-Carlton in South Beach, and it's been a wonderful experience because they've been incredibly, you know, supportive of what I'm doing. For me, I really kind of pinch myself when I think about where I was, you know, years ago, living in that car and all the things I've been through, to the point where now, you know, I've accomplished my goal and dream, which is to be a published author.
And his debut novel is Forever My Lady. That's author Jeff Revere. For more on both Jeff and Urban Lit, go to our website, here-now.org. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jeff Revere's debut novel is Forever My Lady. For more on him and other Urban Lit, go to our website, here-now.org. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for